testing.
One, two, three, good. That works.
Does it need, do you want to amplify it anymore?
That's a good point.
I mean, it's not even getting above half.
So what do you think, like 18 gain?
What does that look like? Oh, that was, okay. Yeah, that's
that looks good.
Sure.
Go to Global Exchange. Global Exchange.
But do we have audio here, or it's just
yeah, but we can't seem to access it in the acoustics, so if not, then we don't need it. So
yeah. Okay.
I give up.
Yeah, this is... I believe we're playing with some of the occurs.
Is it just too big?
Pockets up in the...
No, we can't access... The projector, it's the access is to it from another room, which is locked.
Have you read the Barbara King?
Yeah.
And there's no...
What?
It doesn't seem to be any way to get inside.
Tis the life.
Say what?
Said tis the life. Poison the fire.
Well, it happens.
You know what?
So, under this I'm
thinking about modules. Yeah, no, I'm thinking that as well. You can present the model, he does it well. And everyone has handouts.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Hers is a novel.
Okay, so there's
cheesy things. Missionary.
And dramatically.
Try to look exchange for the problem.
Then nobody was buying water, so the place just went bad. know. Can I explain myself?
So, that's try. I just, all I can do is ask you to try.
Yes.
I'm going to say it, I'll make it easier. I'll basically say that the part that the PowerPoint basically, they've got in front of them, essentially, the PowerPoint. They go through, yeah. I'll go through it briefly. Sure. So I'll aim for 40 minutes, bring some total.
Okay.
Yeah, that's about what we were shooting for, about a half hour.
Okay. And then you can just find out John Osborne.
Oh, good. I got a present for you.
Oh, great.
What?
Yeah. That's the part.
So was looking for extension cord?
We've got someone who's right now getting an extension cord.
Will you promise to get this little sample somehow at some point?
I'm not sure.
Did you mean I can photocopy it otherwise?
Then you can just mail it back to me. I'll give you an email. We can see an
announcement. Okay. There it is. Yeah, actually, it's looking all the posts.
You know where I originally found it was translated into Spanish. I was in Peru for a year in 85, 86, and I came across the Spanish language edition, and that's where I sort of read it and went through carefully and then read it. Somehow I guess. There's been some failures.
I think it's going to try it already.
Oh, yeah. I think I can count six attempts, all of which have ended in a visual failure.
Yeah.
So that's why, let's talk a little bit and see what we're trying to do and how it's working. The latest attempt was a PhD student in my department, a good friend of mine. Yeah. And he's going to be a doctor.
the projector on over there?
Can do that.
I think it's close enough. Oh, there it is.
Could be. Where's the light at? What do you think?
I say close enough.
One more?
It's fine. No, let's try it here.
Okay, put that one here. What's this? What's this? Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see. That's pretty cool. That's very exciting. Yep. I don't know how this works, though.
Okay, so we plug this in on the other. Yeah,
the next question is.
You?
This here?
How
do we?
Got it.
Yeah, it takes a second to warm up.
Okay. Get, John, get your computer, because mine's recording. Okay. And what? Okay. Did I reset this? Oh, that sucks. No.
I think it worked.
Awesome. We've got extension cords.
I am delighted.
Yes, me too.
Do you need that bigger?
Not me.
That's okay? Oh, that's not you.
Not me.
Who is it?
From what?
Who's doing the presentation?
Four of us are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is this big enough?
There should be. I don't know. Let me...
We can move it back one more row.
We can. Yeah, let's move it one back one more row. One more row first.
Hold that there.
Sure. Yeah, that's nice. Okay. Yeah, that's sweet. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Did someone
else?
No. Okay. Putting that
before taking it out. I'm curious.
Yeah. I take that. Okay. Yeah. Pointing it to. Do you have a connecting? Oh, here. John?
Yeah.
Can you?
Sure.
Yeah.
This is one fits. I mean, my adapter for it.
Yeah. No, we have the adapter. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
Huh, yeah, I've got tape. Yeah, take that. Economics. This is a teaching on a model of economics that's very different from any model that most people are conventionally familiar with. Very different from both the market model that you see in capitalist economies and from the central planning model that you would have seen in something like the Soviet bloc countries. The plan for this evening is to present a PowerPoint presentation, which we finally now have working, and we thank you very much for your patience. The plan is to present the model with this PowerPoint presentation for about a half an hour, and four of us involved with CAPES, the Chicago Area Participatory Economic Society, the organization that is organizing tonight's event, will take turns presenting that. Thereafter, we will dive right into remarks by the evening's distinguished guest who flew in this morning, Professor Robin Hanel of American University at Washington, D.C. And he will deliver some remarks shortly thereafter. And then the plan is to basically hand the floor over to questions and discussion and concerns about the model and any thoughts that might come up. Two small favors to ask of everyone. One is, if questions come up in the course of the talk, please
keep them in mind and hold them until the question and answer period, which we've got at least an hour allotted for. And the second thing is to move the mouse. The second thing is actually to, we have the room until 8 o'clock. So if the discussion should run longer than that, we'll kindly ask people to end it there. But if people are interested in discussing the matter further, we'll be more than happy to discuss it at another time or at whatever venue people might be comfortable with. We'll have contact information available. Everyone should have a copy of the handout that we've got in the back. If you don't, raise your hand, we can get you copies. Everyone has a copy? And there's also
a copy.
All right. There's a copy there. There are also flyers, and there is a mail in the sign up sheet if anyone's interested. And so that's all we need to share.
Sure.
Okay, we're up.
Let's start with actually who came up with participatory economics. One of which is Robin Hanno, and the other is Michael Albert. Robin is a professor of economics at American University, author, activist. Michael Albert is an author and an activist, and also one of the founding members of Southland Press and Z Magazine. We are a Chicago area of Participatory Economics Society. We're all situated around the room, John, Mitchell, myself, Matt, and Dylan in the back. Lloyd is outside manning the door because we don't have security.
Just the next slide, if you want the next slide.
Yep, next slide. So this is sort of what we're going to go over in our talk, which was a brief version of our talk, which was taken from the Vancouver Pericon Collective. We're going to go over the values and philosophy of participatory economics, the need for participatory economics, why do we need it, what are some of the problems with other types of economy? Institutions of a participatory economy, which we'll get into more detail. Balanced job complexes, remuneration for effort and sacrifice, council democracy, allocation of participatory planning, and then we'll go over some more information on pericon.org, where you can go and get full books, talks, discussions, criticisms, rebuttals, that sort of thing. These are the values of participatory economics. You'd want any sort of economy to have a good set of values. First one's self-management. People should have decision-making power proportional to how they're affected by the decision. Quite a bit different than how things are in our present economy, where a very narrow range of people have decision-making power, especially in the workplace, where they sometimes have control over the most intimate personal decisions. Going to the bathroom, things like that. Equity, fair remuneration. Participatory economics promotes payment according to effort and sacrifice. Efficiency. You'd want any sort of economy to be efficient, not necessarily in the way that markets are looked at as efficient. We want this to be efficient in that costs on society, labor, and ecology should be minimized. That is another kind of efficiency. Diversity. The economy should promote a range of goods, services, opinions, and cultures, meaning we don't want a homogenized society. Everyone wants choices. And lastly, solidarity. Should promote consideration for others. In the present economy, there's really no solidarity, especially between consumers and sellers, or workers who manufacture products. So we buy a pair of shoes. You don't think about what went into that manufacturing of the shoes or what the worker had to do to manufacture the shoe. What are some of the problems of capitalism and markets? Private ownership creates vast disparities of wealth and power. Creates a virtual wage slavery, where if you're not within that narrow range of people who have wealth and power, you are forced to work for a wage. And if you decide not get very far or starve. Working for other people's profits, I think if anyone looks at that, they find it's pretty much fundamentally immoral. It misallocates resources. Their markets are very inefficient. Lots of negative externalities, such as advertising, pollution, and mind-numbing jobs. The prices in a market don't reflect the true cost of social goods. Well, a gallon of gasoline may cost $3, and that may seem very high, but if you actually factored in all of the social costs, it may cost $10 or $15. And it takes a massive amount of effort to get the output that we get. We work a lot for what the output is in a society like this. So what about the other alternative? What we're told is the other alternative, the sort of central plan, Soviet-style economy. Part of the problem with that, well, the main problem with that, is that Marxists failed to realize that there would be a coordinator class, or a manager class, that would do a lot of the same things that the wealthy and powerful class, or small group of people, does here. They control what's produced, when it's produced, how it's produced, how much of it's produced. So it carries a lot of the same problems that happen in this society.
Missed the slide, but
no.
What?
No, it's on the screen.
Okay.
So John's going to come up and he's going to discuss institutions in more detail. I'm going to take that over.
Okay, I'm briefly going to talk about some of the institutions of contemporary economics: balanced job complexes, remuneration for effort and sacrifice, and cancel democracy. And later on, Lloyd, I think, will talk about historic planning. Go ahead, next slide. So what is a balanced job complex? It's kind of a strange idea, people haven't heard about it before. What does it really mean? It's a job which has a more or less equitable mix of empowering and disempowering tasks. And the reason we want these types of job complexes is that they promote the values of our economy, which Matt just talked about earlier. And what it means in practical terms is that rote, unpleasant, and as well as empowering, pleasant work is going to be shared. People perform a variety of different tasks in different workplaces. So jobs are balanced not only within a particular workplace, but they're also balanced across society in general. So what does that mean? So balancing within a workplace would mean that people, although specialization will still exist, we don't want to have someone perform brain surgery who isn't qualified to perform brain surgery. It does mean that the unpleasant tasks at a workplace will be shared. So that includes everything from, say, typesetting or cleaning the washrooms, those type of activities. Those are going to be shared. Okay, and balancing across workplaces. So part of the problem with this idea, if you really want to balance things, is that some workplaces are inherently more empowering than others. Working, say, at a sewage plant may not be as much fun, no matter how you balance the jobs in that particular place, it's still quite unpleasant. Whereas working in, say, a nice air-conditioned office downtown is a little bit better. And so in order to equalize things entirely across society, not only will people balance their job complexes within their workplace, but also jobs will be balanced across workplaces. So you may work only 3 days a week at a particular job, but you may go 2 weeks and work at another workplace. And there's some real benefits to this. I can talk about them on the next slide. Just poke ahead for that. No, I'll discuss them now though. So one of the advantages with balanced job complexes is that because these kind of crappy jobs really are being shared, there's a real incentive to innovate that doesn't really happen right now. For instance, if you look at the fast food industry, wages are very low in the fast food industry. And so there's no real incentive for capital to invest money in making a wonderful machine which can make great burgers or tacos or whatever, and they can pay someone $6 an hour to do that. And so by forcing everyone to take part in these balanced job complexes, people really want to get rid of those quite quickly. And I really don't think the idea is that counterintuitive, because if you know you live at home with somebody, your spouse or your roommate, quite often crappy jobs, like doing dishes, are shared. So this type of sentiment is going to carry on in general. Go ahead to the next slide. So, are there still incentives to work with balanced job complexes? Well, first of all, people actually have empowering, enjoyable tasks performed. Those are actually shared. So, people who are just stuck doing something they don't like, at least they get to do something that's pretty fun or at least empowering for some percentage of the time. There's still social incentive to produce, and there's still material incentive if one wants to put forth effort or sacrifice. Since each job will be more or less balanced in terms of effort and sacrifice, remuneration will be measured more or less by hours worked. Go ahead to the slide. So here's some of the benefits that I was talking about earlier. So the slide actually is still here. People get a chance to try other professions that they are interested in while keeping their old job. It's a little bit difficult to do right now, because if you step outside your current career or job, it's very difficult to be trained for something else at the same time while holding down the job and trying to make enough money to educate yourself. People aren't slotted into miserable dead-end jobs, and I talked earlier about automation. It's also a full employment opportunity, and it also prevents a monopoly of empowerment and self-promotion among a select elite. So there aren't the same incentives that there are in, say, the old traditional Soviet-style economy for the bureaucrats at the very top of the system to make life much easier for themselves and continue to do that until there's a huge gap between someone who's working at the bottom of the heap and someone who's running the system at the very top. And there's also no need for unions in the traditional capitalist sense, since there's no distinction between management and labor, since there are balanced job complexes. Go ahead to the next slide. Remuneration equity.
Lloyd, before you jump in, or is it?
It's mine. So there are several ways society can reward work. The current system is really payment according to bargaining power and property owned. So that's the system we have right now. Of course, we see vast disparities in wealth and power, and of course, battle between unions and people who actually own the company. There's another way to reward remuneration, which people have talked about in alternative models, is payment according to output. And actually, some workplaces right now, under capitalism, they do exactly this type of reward system. It's called piecework. So we would argue that this isn't necessarily fair. And the example that we have here is comparing Mozart to Salieri. Now, I don't know if you know who Salieri is or not, but he was a contemporary of Mozart, and he worked really hard. I mean, he wrote a fair number of musical pieces. They were not too bad. Worked much harder than Mozart, but they weren't the same quality as Mozart, obviously, which is why most people know about Mozart, not about Salieri. So, and, some would say, well, if you're going to remunerate according to output, Mozart should get a lot more money than Salieri. But we would actually argue that this isn't the case. Really, Mozart just won the genetic lottery. And odds are, if he's going to have this chance in contemporary economic society, he's going to try to do music anyway. That's his love and that's his talent. So we would disagree with winning the genetic lottery, same way we disagree with people getting vast piles of money simply because they inherit it. So that's the third adage right there, payment according to effort and sacrifice. And of course, there's the other remuneration scheme, payment according to need. People think that's pretty fair, but it is impractical in some ways in that there's no incentive at all for people to work. Go ahead to the next slide there. Council democracy. Your slide.
I'd like to talk about the different types of councils that we have in this council democracy.
The two different types that we're going to speak about, first of all, are consumption councils and workers' councils. Consumption councils actually have to do with the participatory budgeting of a municipal city or state, region, slash hopefully world. And the workers' council has to do with the democracy in the workplace. So basically turning around, self-management would be the right response. These councils would mean one person, one vote in some circumstances to deal with problems surrounding small projects, networks of work groups, councils for an entire workplace, and federal councils for an industry. Again, it's a breakdown of a system. So, it's the organization of the system so that everyone has a part and can play a part. Decisions will be made by those directly affected by the decisions. Voters can be required for the majority or two-thirds majority of consensus, etc. Again, this depends on the type of vote and the circumstances surrounding the vote. Let's say, for instance, one particular idea was a swimming pool that has been used over and over again. If the vote affects you directly, let's say you are in the surrounding community and you will use the pool, or the water that the cost of water for that pool is organized into that into your region, the effect of it, that directly correlates to your vote. Let's move on. Workers' councils. Well, to talk about specifically workers' councils, I said earlier that they have to do with self-management. What it basically does is it empowers the entire workforce. It doesn't just empower a certain portion of the workforce. Everyone who's involved in a workers' council has a say in the organization. So if you are partially a janitor, that's the wrong context, but if you are, let's say, a janitor as well as the dean of the University of Chicago, you have say in how the organization of the school is from both perspectives. Workers can deliberate on the details of the workplace, including how to improve job quality, schedule tasks, upgrades, otherwise tasks that they have trained for. In a lot of situations, with a lot of jobs that people have taken, you are given tasks that have nothing to do with the actual job that you train to do. Certain circumstances, like for instance, if you're a designer, as a graphics designer, for instance, you don't just get to design stuff all day, you don't just get to draw. You also have to do budgeting as well as, depending on what part of the organization you're in. But in this particular circumstance, what we're trying to do is create a system so that everyone has a part in how that organization actually occurs. Please, next slide. Now, the other aspect you were talking about earlier between the Consumption Council and the Workers' Council, Consumption Council has to do with, of course, consumption. Basically, what you try to do is create a system. Participants in the economy can make budget decisions for their community. So going back to my swimming pool analogy, the same kind of thing where the community gets to decide that swimming pool goes there. It's not just some guy way up somewhere else going, oh, I have a great notion for a swimming pool in this neighborhood. Different levels of councils. Again, this has to do with how we break down the system. It's on a neighborhood scale, a citywide scale, state, regional, basically as depending on the need and the system that part of this particular version or this particular experiment part of town would be working. Next slide, please. Now we're going to actually talk more about the allocation of participatory planning. And actually, this beautiful image that we have here actually depicts it perfectly. I wish we could have a little bit bigger. But basically what the system is iteration boards, a group in the middle where, proposals from the production unit on one side and the consumer unit on the other go through a computer system of some sort, and they're brought into an iteration board, which Mitchell will discuss in more detail later. The iteration board will then turn around and respond back to the consumption and workers' councils, and then you have this cycle until a deal that works for the entire society slash community. Until you figure out some sort of system that works together, so once you get to that point, then you come out of the cycle. Next slide, please.
We've got a missing graphic.
Oh, can you click once, please? One more time. Okay, so let me explain the overview of allocation. Allocation in part econ is very different from many other types of allocation we're used to. Among economists, there are two accepted means of allocation, means of allocating goods and services to people. As you can see, on one side we have by the market system, and on the left side, on the right side, we have the central planning system. Those are the two basic ideas we have now. Now we're trying to bring in participatory allocation, or participatory planning, or party planning. Is meant to be the third way, and it's a superior allocation system, as you will soon see. So, please bring up, yes. So, party plan in a nutshell. Everyone takes part in this society-wide allocation. More specifically, every person or actor, individuals, neighborhood councils, region councils, national councils, etc.,
makes a plan for their respective allocation, which, if need be, is refined in an iterative procedure until all plans are agreed upon. How would we go about doing this? Well, let's let Mitchell tell us about it.
So to talk about some of the details regarding an allocation system, there are a number of tools that are used in participatory planning. One set of tools involves communication of how different actors in a participatory planning scheme will communicate their particular needs. Three main tools that we focus on here. One is indicative prices. Basically a number to attach to whatever particular product to give some quick snapshot example of what went into that product. Everything from the amount of time that went into it, the resources, like if paper was used, you know, a number of trees that got cut down, other kinds of impacts upon people and planet. This should be clarified in that it's different from the kinds of prices that we have now, in that the kinds of prices we have now reflect competitive market relations, basically where who has a stronger say within the competition of supplying of basically consumers and producers. But here, it's basically a number to reflect what went into a product. And the reason we have this here is to allow some snapshot way to choose from the number, infinite number of possible allocations that are available. That's one tool in this toolbox of communication, indicative prices. The second one is measure of work. Basically, how much work went into a product, whether it was relatively empowering, relatively disempowering, or somewhere in between, and adjust all work proportionally. The reason is we've got balanced job complexes in the society of a mix of both empowering and disempowering tasks for everyone in the economy. And the reason we gauge the measure of work so that we have a gauge of, just move the mouse, get the room. To make sure that those balanced job complexes stay balanced. It's a second tool. Third tool is qualitative activity. All of the actors involved on both sides, both the nested from block-wide, neighborhood-wide, region-wide, nationwide councils, both in production and in consumption, provide some reasonable description in words, more or less. Could be written down, doesn't have to be, of the work and inputs. And the reason we do this is because work is more than just numbers. And we want to give a quick snapshot account of the work input that went into that can't necessarily be quantified. Next slide. Organization. So we've got these one set of tools of how actors can talk to each other. But how are those actors organized among themselves? Well, as we mentioned before and repeatedly, we've got nested worker and consumer councils. And the reason that they're set up at different scales is because some things we produce and consume are at the individual level, for example, a toothbrush. But you also have consumption at increasingly larger scales, like say a mass transit system for an entire city that could serve millions of people. Not the kind of thing that can be readily consumed or produced for an individual level, but done at a larger scale. So we have those nested councils at different scales. An iterative process. Into the process of arriving at a final plan, we include in a number of attempts. And the reason is because we probably won't get at a plan in the first try. You can, great, but in case we can't, we build into the process a system of eventually converging into a final plan for the entire society. And the final organizational component is an iteration facilitation board, IFBs. These are tools to basically help to streamline the process, basically to provide some of the perhaps rote work computation that's necessary to provide feedback for all the various actors, since it'll be very hard for actors to be able to communicate with everyone in the society. You have IFBs set up to help to streamline that process. The reason they have this is to help speed up the process and could take an inordinately long time otherwise. Next slide, please. So you've got these various tools, communication and organization. How does this actually work? where does the rubber hit the road? Well, we start out by having all of the actors, the consumption and production councils at all levels, access the history of previous plans that have already taken place, as well as expected likely future trends. That way, there's all of the actors involved can know more or less where all the various trends in the economy are more or less going and can plan accordingly, or submit plans accordingly. The IFBs will get the ball rolling by announcing a first round of indicative prices on various items within the economy. And with all that information, the indicative prices, previous history, and likely trends, each of the actors involved will make respective plans on the consumption end or production end for what they want to produce or consume over the course of some period of time, say, for example, a year. One scheme about setting this up might be, say, it's October 1st, 2004, and you're going to allot, say, 2 months to figure out an allocation plan for the entirety of 2005, something like that. Next slide. Planning begins. All the actors, as I mentioned, submit up an initial plan subject to peer review. The peer review itself depends on where does the self-management principle, who is impacted by the particular plan that you submit, and does that plan mesh well with who is impacted by that plan? If they approve, great. If they don't, well, you'll have to go back and forth over the iterations to find out what would be a suitable plan. What would the plan look like? Well, it depends on whether you're involved in the consumption or the production side at any given moment. In a consumption side plan, it could be as far as what you want to consume over the course of this given time. On indicative prices, per effort and sacrifice, of course, since you'll be getting more if you put in more effort and sacrifice within the scheme. So it could just be a simple list. Now, for things that you can predict, this is easy. Like, for example, I eat cereal every morning for breakfast, let's say. I can predict that for the next 365 days. I'll have two bowls of cereal for the next 365 days, milk, and maybe some coffee during work day, something like that. But there are other things that you can't predict. Suppose I break my arm over the course of the next year. I can't predict that now. But you can predict that, not necessarily in the individual level, whether or not one given person breaks their arm, but you could predict it on a societal level, or at larger and larger scales, noting for societal trends, for example. And it would be at that level of where the trend would occur, say in a regional, national, or perhaps societal level, where you make a plan there for that particular consumption need. And you'd also allow slack. You'd overplan, like in the case of, say, cereal in the morning. I'd probably want to allow for more than I might consume, just in case there are times in when I'm hungrier in the morning sometimes. You want to account for that additional slack, as it's called. That's consumption side. On the production side, how much work do you expect to do? Say you're involved in a production factory, for lack of a better word, producing widgets for part of your balanced job complex. How many do you figure you're going to make in the course of a year? You just count that out or try to figure out some reasonable estimate. A measure of that, where in the course of the producing these widgets do you do disempowering and relatively empowering work and gradations in between? And the qualitative activity, helpful description of exactly where you're working or what you're working with, to help to account for things that can't be pinned down to a number. Next slide. Each of these actors will, depending on what role they will play in this moment, will submit their respective plans to IFBs. IFBs will do the various necessary computations and return back respective feasibilities of those respective plans. If we all agree on a plan, congratulations, we're done. We've got an allocation plan for this entire society. In a more formal sense, we agree on a plan when there isn't any excess supply left in the society, excess demand left in the society. Once we've got that met, then that is a more formal way of saying that we've agreed on a plan. If we don't agree on a plan, if there's some excess demand remaining, we repeat. We with the feedback, those who produce the plan are asked to revise their particular plans and repeat the process over the course of, well, it depends. various theoretical descriptions of the model say anywhere from 3 to 6 iterations, and tends to be more like 5 in various descriptions that have been seen. So, say, over the course of 5 iterations, eventually a society-wide plan will be arrived. But there's a slight catch, though. In later rounds, we introduce variability limits to make sure that basically the amount of percentage of which you can change your plan is limited. And the reason we do that is because you don't want a constant overshooting and undershooting of respective supply and demand to make sure that eventually they do converge on a society-wide plan. Next slide. Summarizing what I've just described here and in the previous slides in a different way, we've got actors at all these levels, consumer and production, submitting the various plans to IFBs. Those who are impacted by the respective plans decide one way or the other on the feasibility of those plans. The plans themselves take into account various factors, indicative prices, other qualitative and quantitative work factors. Feedback is returned to each of the individual actors. If need be, adjustments are made. A handful of times we go through this process until a society-wide plan is arrived at. Unlike in market economies, there's no competition. I don't have to step on your face in order for me to get ahead. We can both get ahead with participatory planning. There's no big meeting because different people are eventually submitting their respective plans without having to meet. And there isn't even any money involved in this. In fact, in the Vancouver Participatory Economics Collective, a group of people involved in Vancouver, they actually have a cute website. It's called The Economics of Star Trek. And there they actually say that because they don't use any money in Star Trek, they've been using a participatory economy. That's debatable, but in a participatory economy, there is no money. You can arrive at this allocation without having to use that.
I'm already there.
I'm sorry?
I'm already there.
All right. Already there. Next slide. Speaking of there, suppose you like this idea, or might think it might be worth something, be something worth pursuing. How would we get there? Well, unfortunately, we are stuck in the here and now. But we do have options available to try to propel a process that perhaps at some point in the future, however near or distant it might be, might happen. We currently strengthen social institutions that strive to provide some kind of equity according to a participatory remunerative scheme. Things like unions that can organize for things like that. Various campaigns for participatory budgeting. This is a trend that's going on in local and sometimes even national scale governments across the United States. Different people will submit budgets to their respective areas of size, whether it be in a neighborhood, an entire region, entire city, or in the case of a plan in Brazil, an entire country. So things like that, as they're increased and widened out, is another tool for eventually possibly implementing this. And we should also establish balanced job complexes on a private scale wherever we can. This would probably take the form of current businesses that operate in market economies now, but nonetheless have remunerative and participatory institutions within themselves. Examples. Z Magazine, which is a magazine out of Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and they also have a very active component online called ZNet. And it's a magazine. They produce a magazine that anyone can subscribe to with current, but within the Z Magazine, there are balanced job complexes, remuneration for economic sacrifice. Same thing with a book publisher in Boston called South End Press. A book publisher that's been around for more than 30 years, built along the same kind of scheme. There's actually one other example that I myself have a particular fondness for. It's a website of a journalism project out of Syracuse, New York called The New Standard. The New Standard. You can actually check it out online at newstandardnews.net. In matter of fact, they're actually undergoing a full membership drive. If you want to try to help out an effort that's going on right now that can really use your support and that is actually seriously implementing balanced job complexes, check them out, newstandardnews.net. Next slide. us, Chicago Area Participatory Economic Society. If you want to get in touch with us, there's our email, info@chicagoparicon.org. We also have a website set up, chicagoparicon.org. And there's also a website for the larger participatory economics project itself, parecon.org, which is also hosted actually on the ZNet website. Next slide. That's it, you think? Okay, so that concludes the presentation. I hope this was helpful. And a handout basically summarizes in a somewhat different way, but nonetheless touches on a lot of the points that we raised here, what a participatory economy works. We will now change gears a little bit and hand over the floor for some remarks and to start off our question and answer period with a distinguished guest, Professor Robin Hanel, Professor of Economics at American University in Washington, D.C. He is the author of this book, Economic Justice and Democracy from Competition to Cooperation, published by Routledge Press. He is the co-author with Michael Albert of the book, The Political Economy of Participatory Economics, co-inventor of the model of participatory economics. Professor Hanel has been active in many social movements and organizations over the past 40 years, most recently with the Southern Maryland Greens and Green Party USA. We're very privileged and honored to have him here today. Please welcome Professor Robin Hanel.
White Sox, and I hope you get to play my team today with Carter. The first time I've ever been on the campus, University of Chicago, it's strange because both my parents are alumni. My sister went here. I've never been on the campus. I'm glad to be here at the invitation of Capes. It's a very nice way to visit the University of Chicago. I'm going to make brief remarks. The PowerPoint demonstration will leave me of the heavy lifting, which is, what is this idea? What are the basic sort of components of this idea? So you have that. I can tell you a little bit about the sort of the origins. Where did this idea come from? And what do I see as its sort of major purpose? And then what I want to do is briefly address some major concerns that people have raised about this idea and this way of organizing our economic activity since the original publication of, you know, sort of this proposal. It was in 1991 that Michael Albert and I published two books. One was intended for sort of an academic audience of economists, and it was sort of a very rigorous sort of treatment and analysis of a formal model of a participatory economy. And the other book was intended for an audience that we thought would be more receptive to the idea. We didn't think most of our fellow economists were going to be receptive to this idea. But we thought, well, we do have to prove certain things about what this procedure or what these suggestions of these procedures would and would not accomplish or could be expected to accomplish. But we published the book simultaneously for activists, for people who already knew that they were dissatisfied with many of the aspects of capitalist economies and were also not in the least bit attracted by the example of the centrally planned economies such as the Soviet Union. Well, those books were published in 1991, and many, many people have commented in the time since then and raised concerns. So what I'll do is sort of go, I'll mention the major concerns that have been raised. I'm sure that some of them are concerns that have already been raised in your mind as you listen to the PowerPoint presentation. And then I'll try and be very brief in giving a response to those concerns in order to then, they'll come up again. And, you know, when we have time, we're going to have time for question and answers, so I'm sure those things will come up again. Michael Albert and I were both New Left activists back in the 1960s, and we also were studying for our PhDs in economics. And at that point in time, we came to the conclusion that the vision of an economy that was common to many anarchists, council communists, guild socialists, libertarian socialists, that the vision of an economy in which people actually manage their own economic lives, where workers manage themselves at work, where consumers manage their own consumption activities, and where collectives of workers and collectives of consumers jointly manage the way they were going to coordinate their interrelated economic activities, we came to the conclusion that this vision was perfectly sound. But that those who had promoted this vision had not done a very good job of answering some very hard, difficult questions about exactly how would you go about making these kinds of choices and those kinds of choices, and how could you be sure that your procedure would actually generate a plan that was feasible and could be carried out? Why would there be any reason to believe that this plan had any attractive properties, such as it was an efficient plan and it was an equitable plan? We thought there was nothing really wrong with the vision, but there was a tremendous amount of hard intellectual work that needed to be done to sort of explore it and elaborate it more thoroughly. And that was really the original purpose of presenting a model of a participatory economy. It was an attempt to say, this is not an impossibility, but to admit that people who had argued for and fought for this kind of an economy during various periods in the 20th century, that they had not done a good job of explaining exactly how it could be carried out. And it's important to do a good job of explaining how something like this can be done, really for two reasons. One was that the first living example of an alternative to capitalism didn't turn out too well. It turned out to be a bad idea, and it didn't work very well. So the notion that, well, when somebody says capitalism isn't very desirable, we can automatically assume that they have a better idea, well, we had some bitter historical experience. So people had a very good right to be skeptical. So you don't like capitalism, but do you really know what you're talking about? Because it turned out once that things didn't turn out very well. And you could also ask, well, whereas anti-capitalists who believed in central planning could always point to something and say, well, you see, there it is possible. And actually, people who were anti-capitalists believed in a kind of economy that goes under the name of market socialism. We've had real-world examples of market socialism, Yugoslavia from 1952 to 1984-85. And actually, during that time period, the Yugoslav economy performed very, very well. So we've had real-world examples of central planning. We've had real-world examples of market socialism. These are alternatives to capitalism. And people who like those alternatives could point to them. But there really never has been a real-world example of a libertarian socialist economy, an economy where councils of workers and councils of consumers manage their own affairs and jointly plan how they're going to integrate those affairs. Yes, there's, for a brief period of time at the beginning of the Russian Revolution, before it was stamped out, there were sort of small experiments in a libertarian socialist economy. In the aftermath of World War I in northern Italy, there were brief experiences in sort of libertarian socialism. The largest one certainly was the experiment during the period of the Spanish Civil War in the late 1930s in Spain, where anarchist collectives, anarchist agricultural collectives and communes and anarchist-run factories essentially tried to coordinate a part of the Spanish economy during a period of a couple of years. But none of these experiments went on long enough to establish through a living example that this way of doing things is an alternative that we can consider, and we can know that it's a real alternative. So our purpose really from the very beginning, our original purpose was, let's at least demonstrate theoretically that people who are unhappy with capitalism do not have to choose between central planning and market socialism. Let's at least demonstrate theoretically that there is an alternative way to go about managing our economic affairs. Now, what are the kinds of objections that people have raised? I'm going to mention the ones that I think are the most important. One that's very common is too many meetings. It's not going to really help if we set up procedures and a way of running an economy where people are spending 11 and a half months in a year in meetings and arguing and decision making, and that leaves half a month to actually do something and produce something. It just seems, are you describing a system that when it appeared in reality would actually just be too many meetings, people would lose patience with it, people would realize that it's not effective, it's a burden on our time, and it would break down for that reason. I'll talk briefly to that. Second concern was, is this economy really going to be efficient? Or is it going to be so inefficient that if we ever tried it, the majority of the population would say, well, this just isn't what we really want. Now, when we talk about efficiency, there's really three different kinds of efficiency for the economy that economists have to think about. One's called allocated efficiency. You don't want scarce productive resources used in ways where they are not the most valuable. So that's called allocated efficiency, and you want to be sure that you have set up a system of rules and procedures for making decisions that does not lead to inefficiencies in allocating these scarce productive resources. A second is motivational efficiency. Will people really be motivated to do the things? Will real people, people like you and me, regular people, be sufficiently motivated to do the things that this system requires to have, the things that that an economy requires people to do? Or will people simply discover that they're not sufficiently motivated and things don't happen for that reason? And the last is called dynamic efficiency. Will this system prove innovative? Will people be spurred to look for better ways of doing things? And when people discover better ways of doing things, will the system be quick to adopt them and implement them? Now, so we have too many meetings, like a very, very important concern. Will the system actually prove to be efficient, or will it be inefficient in any of these three ways? The third kind of concern that people have voiced over and over again is this economy humanly feasible? Or aren't you just assuming that everybody's going to behave like an altruist? Aren't you just assuming that everybody's going to be like a revolutionary saint, and then you miraculously conclude that, of course, we're going to have wonderful things done because everybody behaved like an altruist? Well, if that's not the way that people are, or many people are, or we can expect people in general to be, then is the system going to break down? Because you've just described a system that maybe it would work fine for revolutionary saints, but not for people, members of the human species. Then the last sort of line of objection, even if I'm convinced that that this way of running an economy is actually feasible and possible, even if I'm convinced that it is much more desirable than the existing alternatives, not just capitalism and central planning, but also market socialism, that it has really attractive features. Even if I'm convinced that it's humanly feasible, that If you put real humans in the context of these institutions, these rules, these procedures for making decisions, people would be motivated to do what they have to do. Real human beings would be motivated, it would work. The last line of objection is to basically observe, but look at the economics of competition and greed that we are mired in at present. Look at where we are. How could we ever actually manage to get from where we are here today to some sort of economy that is an economy of equitable cooperation or operates something along the lines of this participatory economics? Is the political transition hopelessly impossible? So let me just briefly say, I've perked your interest in terms of things to be concerned about. Let me give you some sort of, I'm not going to try and answer these concerns as much as I'm going to make some observations. I'm going to sort of make a couple of points regarding some of them. Too many meetings. When you think about this, I think it's important to break down the question into meetings where. This model has meetings in workplaces inside workers' councils. There are also possibly meetings within consumer councils, neighborhood consumer councils, or federations of consumer councils. So you could have meetings inside workplaces, you could also have meetings in consumer councils, and then of course you might have meetings during this rather hard to explain and even more hard to understand participatory planning process. I want to go straight to the third. There are really no meetings in the participatory planning process. And most people who look at this model and sort of respond to it, they assume contrary. They assume that what we've proposed is actually similar to what many other people have proposed, which is, well, we know that workers' councils and consumer councils have to coordinate their decisions. So I guess we're going to have some big meetings where they come together and sit down and discuss and debate and negotiate exactly how this is going to be done. That's what I call the sort of one big meeting of putting all the sort of parts of the plan together into one overall plan that's feasible. That's the one big meeting approach. And frankly, we think that is a nightmare. And that it really is not feasible that you simply, in one big meeting, can expect these groups to sit down and do anything that is going to make a hell of a lot of sense. But the participatory planning process does not involve meetings. The participatory planning process, what happens is each individual workers' council proposes its own activity. It does not propose what the rest of the economy is going to do. It proposes its own activity, and then in the various iterations, it revises its own proposal. Then it submits the revised proposal to sort of, not consideration and debate in the meeting, but to another round of proposals, which then will be discovered, well, have we finally met something that's feasible? Will we arrive at something that's feasible or not? Now, the incentives are such that it's in the self-interest of the individual councils to revise their proposals in ways that you can demonstrate will eventually reach a feasible plan, but not through a big meeting. So there really are not meetings involved in the planning process, or at least not, they're not meetings between separate production and consumption units to try and hammer something out that is so big and so complicated. What would the agenda of this meeting look like? Now, within workplace meeting time. In hierarchically organized workplaces, there are meetings that a relatively small percentage of the workforce goes to. And that relatively small percentage of the workforce goes to meetings pretty much all the time. That's their jobs. And most of the workforce never goes to a meeting. They just do what the hell they're told. So we're going to have to plead guilty to the fact that in the workplace, more people will end up going to meetings than go to meetings in capitalist workplaces or ever went to meetings in centrally planned sort of hierarchical workplaces. But that's the whole point. We want people to be able to participate in making the decisions about their own work lives, what they're going to produce, how they're going to do it, how they're going to work with other people to do it. We want people to participate in that. Now, that doesn't mean when you're going to those meetings that you're doing it on your leisure time. That's part of your job complex. That's part of what you're getting paid for. But it is true that you won't have a small percentage of the people in a workplace going to meetings 8 hours a day and deciding what everybody else is going to do, and most people aren't going to meetings at all in the workplace. In consumer councils, we propose that the meetings are voluntary. If you go to your neighborhood consumption council meeting and you discuss and debate things like, do we want a swimming pool or do we want a new park with new swing sets, because our neighborhood consumption council is going to have to decide what it is we propose to consume, well, yes. We also think that one of the failures of market economies is that they do not provide people with easy opportunity to express their preferences for social or collective consumption. It's very easy to express your preference for individual consumption items in a market system. It's what economists call the transactions cost of expressing your preferences and your desires regarding collective or social consumption are very, very large in market economies. The participatory economic model and the planning procedure provides people with appropriate vehicles for expressing their desires regarding what sort of social consumption they do want to engage in. And to do that on an even footing with people expressing their desires for individual consumption, so you don't get a bias. Markets basically have an incredible bias in pushing people toward sort of requesting individual consumption rather than social consumption. And the system is sort of intentionally designed to avoid that. Prior to publication of the model in 1991, the consensus amongst most economists was that there's nothing except the market system or a centrally planned system that could possibly achieve allocative efficiency. Well, they were wrong. Alan Nove was I think he's dead now, but he's a very famous British political economist who had studied the Soviet economy his entire life. It was a doctoral dissertation, and he taught about it for decades. And he threw the gauntlet down in no uncertain terms. He said, you can either coordinate the activities of many different producers and consumers through markets, or you can do it through some sort of command system of central planning. There is no third way. Well, that's why we put the model together. That's why we put the model together in a rigorous enough way so that economists can look at it and see, well, could you demonstrate that these procedures would arrive at a plan that was characterized by allocative efficiency? And I can tell you that since 1991, there's been many concerns and objections that have been raised, and not one single economist has come and said, you know what? You're wrong. You're not achieving allocative efficiency. It does achieve allocative efficiency. Motivational efficiency. People are rewarded according to effort and sacrifice, which is the only thing that people have any control over. What is it that you control when you decide to go to work? You don't control how talented you are. You don't control whether you're working with a sort of a brand new machine that's working right or one that's half busted. What you control is sort of the effort you put into things. So the only thing that you control that contributes to whether or not the output that you produce is greater or smaller is your effort. And what we're proposing is that that's exactly what gets rewarded. So it's not only fair to reward effort or sacrifice, because otherwise you are punishing somebody somehow for something they had absolutely no control over. It's not only fair, it's the only efficient way to reward people. You want to reward people for effort because you want to stimulate effort, and that's exactly what the proposal is. Dynamic efficiency. Compared to all previous economic systems, I would concede that capitalism is the most dynamic economy that the human species is devised. But of course, we're comparing it to things like feudalism and slavery, those were previous systems. But it is a very dynamic system. But there's a difference between sort of energetic and dynamic and efficient. If you are running at a breakneck speed, but in a really, really unfortunate direction, if your energies are sort of being, if your energies are being tapped and you are working very hard and you're being very sort of, that's, but if you're running off in a direction that's very counterproductive, that's not interesting. And that's how I would characterize capitalism. Yes, it's very dynamic. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite books is by Julia Shore. She's an economist who now teaches in the sociology department at Boston College. She wrote a book that many of you may have heard called The Overworked American. And she noticed a very simple thing. She looked at the United States at the end of World War II and then again in 1990. And she said, you know, productivity in the U.S. economy has doubled between roughly 1950 and 1990. And yet, the average American is working more hours in 1990 than in 1950. So why did we take the doubling of our productivity all in the form of extra consumption, mostly of individual types of items at terrible cost to the environment? Why did we take none of this tremendous increase in productivity in the form of more leisure? Well, that stimulated her second book, which was The Overspent American. And there's something about this system that is directing us to use this increased productivity in an incredibly sort of counterproductive way in terms of sort of meeting our true needs. Why would we characterize capitalism in that sense? Well, on the other hand, I certainly believe that an economy that did not promote innovation and implement innovation would be very unfortunate indeed. Not because I think that we need to continue our present direction of developing ever more material consumption at the expense of the environment. But if we are going to actually reverse environmental destruction and protect the environment, and if we are going to bring the billions of people on this planet who do not have enough basic goods and services to consume and suffer because of that, that's going to require a large amount of innovation. So we want an economy to be innovative. Well, the proposal in a participatory economy is as follows, that as soon as any workplace comes up with a new innovation, contrary to capitalism, where you can patent that and keep everybody else from using it for 7 years, it would be immediately spread to every workplace. We're not going to be patenting technologies so that somebody can profit from them in order to sort of provide an incentive for people to look for those innovations. That's incredibly counterproductive. It's very much at the cost of what is called allocative efficiency. It means for 7 years, you've got most of the economy using technologies that aren't the best one available. Well, there's another way to do it. You can try to reward innovation through all sorts of non-material incentives, social rewards, social recognition. And in an economy such as a participatory economy, I believe that that kind of incentive would be far more powerful than it is in a society which basically teaches everybody that the only way you can demonstrate sort of prowess and status is by greater material consumption. That's how you demonstrate your value in capitalism. That's not going to be how you demonstrate your value to your fellow humans in a participatory economy. On the other hand, it is also possible to reward innovating enterprises with temporary increases in consumption and or reduced or more desirable work complexes, if that proves necessary. If the social rewards prove not to be enough, that's a decision that people living in a participatory economy can make. But there's a mechanism within the system so that you can increase rewards for innovation without doing it at the expense of having those innovative techniques spread immediately to absolutely everybody that could be using them. humanly feasible. We very carefully did not design a system that required people to behave in an altruistic way. If the system requires, if the only way that people can act in other people's interest is to the detriment of their own self-interest, I do think it would be utopian to expect people to do that day in and day out, year in and year out. But the idea was to design a system where when people did pursue their self-interest under the rules and procedures of the system, that they did actually end up acting in the social interest. And we were very, very conservative in our methodology. We basically analyzed our procedures from the point of view of what would it be in the individual interests of workers to do under these rules? What would it be in the individual interests of consumers to do under these rules? What would it be in the individual interests of a workers' council and a consumers' council to do under the rules of participatory planning? So let's assume that everybody behaved according to their own self-interest. Under these rules, what would you get? And the rules are designed in a way so that what you get is when people do act in their own self-interest, they actually serve the social interest, which is unfortunately not the case frequently in capitalist economies and was not the case in centrally planned economies either. So we weren't naive and just assume that everybody would be a revolutionary saint and here's a system where it would work well. We actually used a very conservative economic methodology to analyze and predict what would be the consequences of self-interested actors acting in the context of these rules and procedures. Now, lastly, and I'll be very brief here, getting from where we are to someplace like a participatory economy. From 1991 up to well into the new millennium, people have been asking Michael Albert and me, well, have you got an answer for that question? And we mostly have been saying, no. You know why? That's the hard question. That's far away the hardest question. And it takes a lot more thinking. And it probably takes a lot more thinking of a lot more people. But both Michael and I have written two things recently, separately, but we both tried to address that issue. And part four of my new book with Rutledge is basically trying to answer that question. And I'll tell you what my answer is in brief. If you look, that book starts out with the following observation. At the beginning of the 20th century, how powerful were the forces that were opposed to the economics of competition and greed and were desirous of and searching for a way of implementing some sort of economics of equitable cooperation? Just how powerful were those forces at the beginning of the 20th century? And then if you ask again, how powerful were those forces at the beginning of the 21st century? They were far less powerful. We went backwards during that 100 years. So we must have done a hell of a lot of things wrong. Now some of those things I think are easy to identify. The entire sort of experience of Marxism, Leninism, and central planning was a terrible mistake. And we paid terrible consequences for that in terms of credibility about the idea that there's a viable and desirable alternative to capitalism. But there are two groups that worked very hard during the 20th century. Social Democrats. In this country, you would call them the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, or the sort of New Deal wing of the Democratic Party. In Europe, they actually are social democratic parties who started the 20th century absolutely committed to replacing capitalism with some system of democratic planning, but who ended the 20th century powerless in most of their economies and having ended up serving as the handmaidens of capitalism and the apologists for capitalism while they worked for sort of smaller and smaller reforms. So we have the experience of social democracy to sort of learn from. We also have the experience of libertarian socialism. I think of myself as a libertarian socialist. And in my chapter on libertarian socialists, I begin by saying, we were the greatest underachievers of all anti-capitalists in the 20th century. And that poses a dilemma. If I think the libertarian socialists probably had the best ideas, how the hell did they end up being the worst underachievers of all the sort of movements and political movements that were trying to either reform or replace capitalism in the last century? This is the idea in a nutshell. We're going to have to work to build reform movements. Movements that are working for reforms within capitalism. And we're going to have to recognize that that's something that's going to have to go on for decades. Starting from where we are, decades. And I analyze a whole number of campaigns that we can work on. And I analyze a number of movements. Campaigns like taming finance within capitalism, achieving full employment macroeconomic policies, tax reform so it's both equitable and efficient, green taxes and fair taxes, living wage campaigns, single-payer health care, community development campaigns, anti-sprawl campaigns. These and a number of economic reform campaigns we are going to have to work in, we're going to have to work hard in. We're going to have to learn how to do that in ways different from the ways the Social Democrats did in the century past. And that's part of what I'm trying to try and address in the book also. But it's not going to be enough. That isn't going to do it. And if that's all we did, I think at the end of the 21st century, we'd end up in exactly the same place social democrats ended up at the end of the 20th century. We would essentially have been victims of the dynamics of fighting for reforms only. I think we simultaneously have to do something else. We have to build living experiments in equitable cooperation within capitalism. We have to, there are a number of such experiments that exist that are ongoing that have to be strengthened and have to be connected. It's not my favorite, but there are some elements that I think are positive about local currency systems, certainly producer cooperatives, certainly consumer cooperatives, looking for ways to link producer and consumer cooperatives and have them work as a network rather than only having to interact through competitive markets with capitalist businesses. I think the left needs to take a long look at the history of egalitarian living communities in the United States. There's a surprising number of egalitarian living communities that are out there that the self-conscious organized left seems to be completely unaware of. And yet, those are communities where many of the ideas that are part of participatory economics are actually being used and implemented and been tried out over periods of time. There are now a handful of participatory economic collectives and groups that are sort of supporting and promoting the idea of participatory economics. I basically think that we have a long way to go. We need to recognize that we are not talking about overthrowing capitalism in a period of 5 years. I am tired of waiting for the next Marxist crisis, which will never come. That's not how capitalism is going to be overthrown. We are going to have to build the labor movement, the anti-corporate movement, the consumer movement. We're going to have to build the poor people's movement that leads all of those. We're going to have to build the global justice movement. They're going to have to become much more powerful, much deeper, and have a much better understanding of how it is that they must fight for reforms, why they will never achieve their objectives as long as we leave private enterprise and markets in control of the system, why they have to replace that system with a whole different way of organizing economic activities if they're to accomplish their goals. We have to build those movements, and we have to build these experiments in equitable cooperation to demonstrate to others that it's possible, to test our own ideas out in practice and see where we're wrong and where we're naive and where things don't work when you want them to go on for a long period of time. And also, I think that's where activists, that's where people fighting in reform campaigns over decades, by working and also living in living experiments in equitable cooperation. I think that's how you prevent burnout. I think that's how you prevent sellout. And I think that kind of dual strategy is the strategy that can work and can lead to the, can end up defeating the economics of competition and greed that we're mired in at this point in human history, and lead to a very different phase of human history at some point in the next century. Thank you very much. So we're open for questions and comments. Yes, sir.
Do you believe that the tax system is necessary to equitable income? And do you realize how money is created, the medium of exchange for this private property? Do you realize the mechanism of the creation of money right now? And do you suspect that the tax system is unnecessary and in fact insane?
Well, I think there are many, many counterproductive and undesirable features of the tax system.
The whole bit is really, that's the reason we're...
At this point in time, those who are most able to pay taxes are the ones who are most frequently excused from taxes. The tax system is incredibly unjust. That's the first problem with it.
Is it at all necessary, or is it insane to be able to create money with ciphers on a page in the bank and pretend like you can't create any more money than is created, so that most of the people in the world don't have the means to even eat, let alone?
I do believe that in a market economy, we do need to collect taxes. The reason is this. In a market...
In other words, it makes no difference, you're saying, how money is created and how much can be created. Well, they pretend to you right now, if you don't know the mechanisms for the creation of money in this society, then you really can't talk very well about the subject. I would say to you, do you realize that the net capital that is associated with stockbrokers, where a stockbroker is bankrupt if he owns more than 20 times what he has invested in the business. This really means that he can borrow 20 times what he has invested in his brokerage. And that money is created for him.
I think in some major respects we are on the same page, that the financial sector, the stock market.
I'm talking about the creation of money. I'm not talking about no one financial sector. That was just an example of the creation of money in this society. These people create money for stockbrokers to play with this private property. They create money for AAA corporations. That's what the Federal Reserve Bank was really set up for, to create money for only the creditworthy people. AAA corporations, that's really what AAA is all about in this country.
The financial sector is very unfair in terms of who they provide credit to or make money for and give to, if you want to put it that way. The financial system is very unfair. The tax system is very unfair. The tax system is very counterproductive in the sense that what's mostly taxed...
It is necessary. It is not necessary.
Well, this is where I think we just...
You talk about money under party fund, or lack thereof. Maybe that would be better.
In a capitalist economy, you have to have money.
We're not arguing about that.
Okay.
We're arguing about how to get rid of it.
The truth of the matter,
where you have to have money.
You can't get rid of it in a capitalist economy, is the problem.
Instead of a market sale of profit. You only need money when you have private property, and you want to exchange private property. The question is really, how do we get out of the system of private property into a system of common property?
Well,
I've been studying this for 16
years. Well, if you follow the presentation, a participatory economy is an economy where productive property and land is not privately owned by anybody who can then make profit off of its ownership. Instead, resource
Natural resources, land, and all of the natural resources are considered part of the public patrimony. And the issue is not who owns it, because nobody does, but we want to be sure that collectively we protect it and we use it effectively and efficiently and not wastefully. But we do that through procedures that do not make into private property pieces of land and natural resources. In a market economy, here, the problem with taxes is this. If you don't collect taxes and have a government buy what we call public goods, there won't be any public goods in a market economy.
They have to have money to exchange this private property. It's the medium of exchange for private property.
If you want public schools, you'll have to have taxes.
No.
If you want public systems of transportation, you'll have to have taxes.
All you have to do is, just like they do now, is credit the account in the bank and let them write a check or whatever they want to do. Money right now, most of the money that is created is not in bills, it's your permission, but it's in central bank credits where they credit the account of AAA corporations. They credit the accounts of these stockbrokers. He can borrow 20 times the net capital rule in stocks. He can borrow 20 times the amount of money he has invested in that.
Sir, I...
That means that money is created.
Sir, right? What is her?
I actually didn't come here to hear you speak.
What did you do?
I came here to hear you speak. It is a discussion.
It is a discussion.
You're monopolizing the discussion.
No,
I'd like you to stop.
He's monopolizing the discussion. Anything I try to suggest, he tried to make it out to be something silly.
No.
You don't know why the Federal Reserve
is
and who it's created.
It would seem this would probably be a longer term discussion that Professor Hanel would probably have later on. But in the meantime, I see five hands posted up. I'm just going to arbitrarily choose you first. I'm sorry.
It's a shorter question. It's longer than the vein. It's about education, actually. I mean, it seems what you're doing is, like, doctors will now also have to sweep the streets and things like that. But what I'm wondering is how the less educated people are going to be incorporated into more empowering jobs. And if they're going to be leaders, then where are they going to get the education to be resourceful leaders?
Okay. In broad terms, if you think about if you actually achieve the organization of a participatory economy, where many more people are participating and making many more decisions than we currently have, doesn't that imply something about changes that you would need to make in the education system as well? And I would say yes. You need an education system that actually helps educate people to think and analyze and participate with others in decision making, and we mostly don't have an education system where that's the way it functions for a majority of the population, because we don't need one, because we don't want a majority of the population taking part in decisions. So yes, there's on the narrow issue of, if you're going to have doctors spending some of their time changing bedpans, is there an element of inefficiency in this? And there is a certain kind of inefficiency in this. I call it the scarce talent problem with balancing job complexes. That anytime you have somebody, if you have a scarce talent and you have that talent, the person who has that talent doing something other than the thing that they have that talent in, well, there's a certain sort of inefficiency in that. It has to be balanced against, and there's two, first of all, there's a solution for that. One is that if we have, let's say we have doctors performing non-doctoring tasks for 10% of their time, that means we're going to have to train 10% more doctors. And is there a social cost to training 10% more doctors? Yes. On the other hand, is it impossible to train 10% more doctors? Of course it's not. So it's not like we're going to go without doctoring because we have doctors sometimes doing things other than what doctors do presently. But you have to weigh the sort of efficiency loss that a doctor is not using every minute of his time doing doctoring tasks against what every economic study has sort of demonstrated. When there's an increase in participation of people in workplaces, in the decisions about what's going on in their workplace, there is always a noticeable increase in productivity and output. So if you succeed through balancing job complexes in creating a workforce that effectively participates more in decision making, there will be a productivity enhancing effect from that greater participation that you would have to weigh and balance against sort of any loss of efficiency that you did not economize on, you know, every scarce talent and every socially costly training component in the economy. And of course, then you'd also have to weigh that against the sort of equity gain that balancing for empowerment, balancing for desirability does. Even if there was, on balance, an efficiency loss, and I don't concede that there necessarily is, even if on balance there was an efficiency loss, you would presumably have to weigh that against, well, but there is a gain in terms of equity, and there is a gain in terms, and there is a gain in terms of economic democracy. So is it worth it?
So in, I guess in any macroeconomics class, you learn that like there's this necessary exchange between the unemployment rate and inflation. But you're saying in participatory economics, you can have full employment, and I'm wondering, I guess, first of all, what you think about that sort of statement and how that happens when you don't have money.
There's a fundamental difference between market economies and planned economies. In terms of what kinds of problems they tend to have. And one of the problems that market economies have is maintaining full employment. And maintaining full employment without upward pressure on prices, the Phillips curve, the trade-off between those two things. Even really badly planned economies, like the Soviet Union, they didn't really have a problem with full employment. There were people out there who wanted jobs who couldn't find jobs in that economy, and that's actually one of the advantages of a planned economy. The plan basically ends up saying, we have so many people who are able, ready to work, and want to work, and the plan is going to make sure that they all have a job before we sort of sit down and start to implement the plan. So unemployment is solving unemployment issues in planned economies is fundamentally different than solving it in market economies. In terms of inflation, we also, it's not a money economy. We do have prices, but these are simply prices used during a planning process, and the economy would achieve full employment without inflationary pressures. There really isn't inflation in the system.
Hand back there.
In a market system, in order to start a business, you have a financial sector which gets loans and whatnot. What's the mechanism in a participatory economic system whereby if you want to start, say, a new business, yeah. I mean, even though it would have a workers' board and whatnot, how would you get it around getting, I suppose, capital to this?
That's right. If you want to start a new business in a capitalist economy, what do you have to do? You have to be wealthy. Or you have to go and pitch to some venture capitalists, or you have to go to a loan officer at a bank. You somehow have to convince somebody that either you've got the money to put up yourself, or you've got to convince somebody else that it's worth taking a bet on you. In a participatory economy, workers are free to bid on any job complex they want within their present workplace. They are free to leave their present workplace and go and apply to work at any other workers' council they choose. And any group, small group, or even one person who wants to start up a new workers' council and workplace is perfectly free to do so. Now, who does that group have to convince that they have a credible proposal? They basically have to convince the Federation of Workers' Councils in that industry. Because you basically are going to have, what you're going to need to get is permission to participate as a workers' council in the planning process. Because in the planning process, you say, these are the inputs that I need the plan to give me, and these are the outputs that I basically promise to deliver if I'm given these inputs. Well, there's a credibility issue.
There has to be
a judgment. We're treating people are in the planning process. What different groups of workers are doing is bidding for everybody else's permission to use resources that are part of common property, permission to use them. And what they have to demonstrate is that they deserve the permission to use them because they are going to be using them efficiently, producing things that other people want, and that they are going to be working, doing their fair share of hard work when they are using those things. But effectively, what you have to do is you have to convince the industry federation has to say, this is a credible group. They should be allowed to participate in the planning process. And you need that approval, or you need something like that, because in the planning process, if a workers' council says, if you give me these inputs, I'll provide these outputs, other people have to know that's credible. They have to know that that's just not total malarkey. So there does have, but it's not a loan officer or a bank that's making that call. It's not a venture capitalist who's making that call. It's basically other workers in the industry that you have proposed you want to set up a workers' council in, saying, yep, they've got people who know the business, they do have an idea, what they're proposing makes sense, it's feasible, it's not totally wacko, and it's not totally crazy and a waste of all our time. So that's where you have to go. You're basically getting the approval from a federation, the industry federation, that you're not a bunch of crackpots. And therefore, you deserve the chance to participate in the participatory planning process, asking for resources in exchange for promising to deliver outputs.
Sir?
Yes. I'd like to make a few observations, but you don't have to answer the question.
Go right ahead.
Just some potential downfalls. I'm going to use some of the examples in the handout. One of them I'm going to speak to is compensation for the runner based on the improvement in his or her time,
yeah,
as opposed to place. And I think what's failed to be realized is there's like a diminishing return on effort. It's easier to go from an 8-minute mile to a 6-minute mile than go from a 5-minute mile to a 4-minute mile. It's easier than to go from a 4-minute mile to a 3:59 mile. The effort might be greater, but how do you measure that? Just a question. There's also sacrifice. How do you define sacrifice? It's very different for different people. Someone might have young children at home and value being at home. And if they're not at home, it's a huge sacrifice. Some people could care less about being home. You know, so maybe there's a lot of things that have to be weighed in there. Nowhere in here is there any discussion about the participation of those risking capital. I'm not sure where that fits in. Somewhere down the road, someone's investing in something initially. And in a lot of your, I think the young woman here, I can easily see as an entrepreneur myself, the top down, you know, I pretty much know every job in the office, but the lowest person in my office can't do my job when I go out and certify the financial statement. So I can see it going down, I can't necessarily see it going up. Sure.
That
we'll your
last comment is absolutely, you're right. Your last comment points out that I did not answer your question. I'm sorry for that.
You can't have people doing tasks that they are not properly trained for, or that they just don't have the ability to carry out. That's insane. We're not proposing that. But I don't believe it's true that there are not tasks that are empowering, and there are not tasks that are somewhat more desirable and pleasant, that the lowliest employee, you know, in capitalist businesses cannot actually carry out. There are going to have to be meetings that decide things like, when do we take coffee breaks? You know, and what sort of food do we want to have people bringing us so that we are there? There are going to be meetings to decide things like that. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to have advanced degrees to have sensible ideas and comments and to effectively express your preferences and your opinions on those sorts of subjects. So what we're talking about, the balancing of the job complexes is something that a committee within the workplace is going to do. So there's no reason to believe that workers in a workers' council are going to be completely impractical in terms of how they balance job complexes. It would be very contrary to their interests to come up with a balancing that is ridiculously dysfunctional or impractical.
So the balancing won't be the same as equality, basically.
Well, it's not true that everybody's going to do the same. Jobs aren't going to be identical.
I'm just trying to understand for myself.
It's just that every job would have some component or tasks that have an empowering effect on the person who carries them out. And every job would also have some of those rote tasks that nobody wants to do. Your other question basically had to do with, well, who's going to make the judgment about effort and sacrifice? And we have a very, very specific response to that. It's going to be a committee of your workmates. There's going to be an effort rating committee. And I wouldn't expect that effort rating committee to work the same in every workers' council. If I were in this economy, one of the first things I would look at when I'm trying to decide, do I want to work in this workers' council or that? I'd ask them, what's your effort rating committee procedure? What's your effort rating procedure look like? I mean, do you have a committee of four? Do people rotate through? Do you try and measure this like, you know, one person's effort was 89 and one person's was 102? Or do you just sort of have, you know, unsatisfactory, satisfactory, and superior? What's your grievance procedure? If I don't like the way that my effort was rating, I mean, what sort of... I would ask those questions about every place I was thinking of working, knowing that different groups of workers are going to come up with different answers. And then I would look for the one that I felt most comfortable with. But, at one point I remember putting it this way. Having your coworkers make the judgment call on your effort or sacrifice is the worst possible way to decide that, except for all the alternatives. was it George Bernard Shaw that said that democracy was the worst political system imaginable, except for all the alternatives?
Churchill.
I would make that with Churchill.
How do you define democracy?
Decision-making input in proportion to the degree you're affected by the decision is how I define economic democracy.
Woman in the gray shirt. Go ahead.
Okay, this is a question on the consumption side. Did you make mention of the fact that it works well in terms of collective or social consumption? But I imagine that if I'm a part of a consumption council and I've made less effort than someone else who's in the same consumption council, it would be in my interest to try to compel them to support more social consumption or more things that are going to affect my collective and my consumption group. And I just wonder if that's kind of a pressure that would constrain or put a pressure against people's own self-interest to continue to put in work in excess of what their collective.
If you and I are in the same neighborhood consumption council and you have a lower effort rating than I do, when we finally agree in our neighborhood council on what our collective consumption request is, you and I are going to be charged for the same amount of the social cost of that, which is simply going to leave you less to engage in individual consumption than I. Now, you might take that into account and say, well, my effort rating is low, and if I vote in the neighborhood for a new swimming pool, that's going to be a rather large collective consumption request for the neighborhood, and I'm going to be left with a hell of a lot less individual, it's not going to be a hell of a lot less, but somewhat less individual consumption than other people in my neighborhood. So you might argue that, well, the people with higher effort ratings in the neighborhood council might have a tendency to argue and vote for larger collective consumption because they would be still left with more individual. But that's effectively, that's the way it would work out. And then you essentially are facing, there's two things you can do. If you don't like the magnitude or the form or which particular neighborhood collective consumption things they ask, you think they're asking for more than you would want to, or not the ones you want, then that's the signal that you need to look for a neighborhood that's more to your liking. It's also a signal that when you decide whether or not you're going to sort of work harder or not work harder, what you're really deciding is on how much individual consumption you're going to have after you assess your sort of proportionate share of the social cost of the collective consumption that you're engaging in, depending on what neighborhood you're in or what region you're in and what their collective consumption is.
We have about 7 minutes before 8 o'clock. Let me first get a tally of who else has a question, who hasn't asked one yet. One, two, no? Maybe, okay.
So one, two, three. I'll try and be very short answering so we get as many people in.
Yeah, as many as we can. Go ahead, please.
Okay, I want to find out a little bit more about where some of these ideas have been tried out. And it seems to me that things like councils and committees have at least been discussed in places like Libya and Venezuela. Do you see any overlap between the activities and or the cripples for activities in those locations and what you're talking about?
There's three. In Kerala, India, they have attempted a system for over a decade now of participatory budgeting, which is sort of village councils deciding on their collective consumption and democratic meetings and procedures. In Porto Alegre, Brazil, and in the entire province that Porto Alegre is in, they've had various attempts of that kind. There are some very interesting ongoing experiments in both cooperatives and in neighborhood sort of decision-making about budgeting and collective consumption going on in Venezuela now. But is there any real-world example of a fully functioning participatory economy that's ever existed in history that we can point to and say, well, did it work and how well? There is none.
There.
I just want to say that, yeah, that I agree with you that there need to be some, like, examples in capitalism of how to make this work. I agree with you with that, but then I disagree with capitalism, I disagree with Marxism and communism, but then when I look at the system, I have some questions, and part of it has to do with junk job complex that you brought up, for example, that the doctor, like, cleaning out bedpans, and then 10% of the time spent there, then you just get 10% of the doctors. But I see the problem with that is that if the doctor is doing such very, very good, very peculiar, very specific work, like I had to deal with certain members of my family, but it was like vascular surgery, which was very tricky, you need a lot of training, you need a lot of skill, and then you're assuming that there'll be those 10% just jump right in and become these doctors, but I think there'll be a problem with trying to get the same, the qualified people to fill these jobs. There might be, but there's a chance that you might not be replacing such, like, really, I mean, very specific, kind of very specialized and very important doctors, for example. And the second thing I had was about going to the industry federation if you want to start a business. If you have an idea that's very kind of revolutionary, for example, I see it problematic that you have to go to the same people who might be, what if they're behind on the times or something? You have some new technology and they will not allow you maybe to participate or have set up your own business just because that will cause them to suddenly you'll become a very good company and everyone will want job complexes within your company and then we'll have to redo all their kind of equipment, all their setup, and so you kind of why aren't whoever wants to set up a business kind of just goes to the consumers and see if your what you're providing is actually, I know it's how capitalism sort of sometimes works, but why is that kind of, you have to kind of go to the people who might just say no based.
The problem is in capitalism, when you set up a new business, you do not go to the consumers to get permission to do it. You go to the venture capitalists and the loan officers at the bank. It's not the consumers. In the case, if you start up a new business and if you start up a new worker council, that the other councils in the federation, you're not competing against them. You don't pose any threat to them. And as a matter of fact, if your idea turns out to be a better mousetrap, they're going to get handed that new technology on a silver platter. They're not going to have to, you know, wait 7 years or pay you for a patent right license on it. So you may be right that a federation council would be sort of a little bit too fuddy-duddy, and they might sort of not see the brilliant idea and think it's wacko, and then say, well, okay, we just don't sanction you as a credible, you know, participant in the planning process. That could be a practical problem. You're right that you can, to the extent that Part of the answer is you just have to graduate 10% more people from medical school. Now, the part of your question that does not answer, and that's easy enough. The part of the question that doesn't answer, what you're basically saying is, well, if you graduate 10% more from medical school, aren't you digging down lower in the talent pool for doctors, and will we have suffering in quality? I have such a low opinion of doctors, it's hard for me to discuss this. It's a possibility.
What about the Cuban example in that sense?
What about
the Cuban example in that sense? I mean, Cuba has a lot of them.
Yes, they do.
In proportion to their population.
And what the Cuban doctors are best at is the circumstances of places like Katrina and Rita, and they go every place in the world to take care of tropical disasters, and they're the world's best at it.
We have time for one more question. Go ahead.
This is something anyone can ask, but what is the diversity in Capes now, and what are the demographics of people who share this idea that, like, you know, when they are eliminated, you reach different ethnicities? What does it look like right now?
You're talking about Capes.
Yeah, Capes, okay. Or any, you know, people who support these ideas of where it comes. What does that look like in today's appearance?
I can address Capes if you want to address the second part
sure.
of the question. Capes is a very new group. We started about 8 months ago, and so far it's just the five of us who were involved in this. You want to just raise your hands and look around the room?
Yeah, it's actually five white guys.
Yeah, pretty much. But like I said, it's still very
five
new.
Five white overeducated white guys.
Oh, Lord. Don't get me started. So it's still very new. But we invite anyone and everyone who is interested. We're going to have a meeting next Wednesday, plan to, Gourmand Cafe downtown. And if you know people who would like to get involved, please stop by or get in touch with us. You can there's a sign-up sheet, or give us your phone number. We can call you. Yeah, we invite participation from all comers. We're still quite new with this, so yeah, we got a ways to go. We know that.
In general, I think that if you look at people who think of themselves as libertarian socialists in the United States today, that there is a tremendous bias that they are more likely, they're going to be disproportionately white, male, educated, with access to computer technology. Absolutely no doubt about it. And is it a serious problem in terms of sort of outreach and sort of who is incorporated in generating the ideas, you know, that are going to be implemented? Yes.
We don't really court what, as well as we should, working class individuals in different neighborhoods. We go to universities, things like that. It's not
really good. Right. The only other presentation that Capes has done was a presentation at the Chicago Social Forum back on May 1st. So, like I said, it's still very new. Just been meeting. We actually met through meetup.com. Is how this thing got started.
There's like a Chicago, there's like a Princeton Economics group in just about every day.
Yeah. There are a number in cities across the United States. You can go to meetup.com and see those who have decided to stay on. I'm afraid we're at a little bit past time. It's a little bit after 8 o'clock. As much as I would like to continue this, I'm afraid we'll have to end it here. But I'd like to thank you all for coming. Thank you for participating. Thank you to the guests who have come out. And if you'd like to learn more or discuss this, please get in touch with us.
I have 3 copies of my book that I would love to sell. I don't want to take them back to Maryland. I don't even want to take them back to the north side of Chicago.
How much?
$15. That's $5 off the store.
I have a question.
Yes.
I just wanted to say, you want to like my new standard?
Yeah, a new standard.
Garjamal. He's coming to speak at Northwestern. We're part of a student group, the Training. And like, we actually have flyers November 7th. Yeah, so if you want to take one and put it up somewhere.
Yeah, no, Garjamal. I've met Don. Yeah. He was here in April giving a talk at the Chicago Peace Museum. You guys can glad he's coming back.
Yeah, we'll
be
back.
Yeah, I'll be sure to post
it.
I can announce this on my radio show as well.
Okay.
I have a radio show on the radio station.
Amazing.
Hey. Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for coming.
So when is your next meeting?
Next Wednesday.
Okay.
Yeah.
What time is it?
6:30. Yeah, if you can, but if not, just let me know and we'll figure it out. Good to see you.
Yeah, it was good to see you.
Let me shut this off.